And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And my guests today are Betsy Amster and Chris Beatty. First up is Betsy Amster. Betsy is president of Betsy Amster Literary Enterprises, a literary agency in L.A. Before opening her agency in 1992, she spent 10 years as an editor at Pantheon and Vintage and 2 years as editorial director of the Globe Pequot Press. A frequent instructor in UCLA's Extension Writing Program, she also runs publishing workshops at The Loft in Minneapolis and at the Squaw Valley Community of Writers. She represents a variety of best-selling writers, including Maria Amparo Escandon, Joy Nicholson, Dr. Elaine Aron, Dr. Wendy Mogul, Dr. Linda Acridolo, Dr. Susan Goodwin, and she's my agent, too. And if her name is familiar, it's because she's been on the show before. We've talked on the air before, and also, maybe 2 months ago, maybe not quite that, we tried to bring her on, and we were experiencing static distortion, and it was not pleasant. And so we decided to cut our losses and try again. So we're going to try again. Keep your fingers crossed. Hi, Betsy.
Hi there.
Can you hear me?
It's perfect.
Thank goodness.
Yes.
So we have a half hour to talk about all the things we need to talk about in publishing and agenting. And I'm real curious, especially for our listeners who aren't able to talk with agents very much at all, if at all, to hear about what you take, what you're looking for, what thrills you when it comes in your mailbox.
Well, I am looking for material that is fully realized, for one thing. I prefer literary fiction to commercial fiction, although I do occasionally take on commercial women's fiction, and also the occasional mystery. In nonfiction, I like working with journalists, narrative nonfiction. Memoirs have become very tough, although if they're very well written, I think, and unusual, I think they still stand a chance. I like self-help and psychology, particularly research-based psychology, and also quirky gift books, photography, design, lifestyle sorts of things.
Now, backing up a little, you mentioned literary over commercial fiction, and occasionally I have people ask me, what's the difference? Is it the language?
I think commercial fiction is more plot-driven. Literary fiction, voice is really important, characterization is really important. Sometimes literary fiction will cross over and have commercial appeal. Leif Enger's Peace Like a River was a book like that. Cold Mountain was a book like that. Zadie Smith's White Teeth, very literary work that still found a large audience.
But you can never predict, or can you? I mean, do commercial books or books that you think might cross over, do they have bigger themes? Do they have more blockbuster type of plots?
Some sometimes they end up getting more support from the publisher for whatever reason. I've had two scenarios. One where the publisher has made a big investment in the author at the outset and then has really paid a lot of attention as the book went down the line from editorial to publicity and out into the world. And other scenarios where they may not have paid that much for a book, but a publicist falls in love with it and goes all out, a publicist with the support of the house, kind of after the fact, falls in love with the book and just goes crazy with it. Either way is dandy.
Hmm. Now, how is that determined? How is it determined what books during a season, a particular season, are promoted more than other books? Is it that the editor or somebody at a house really just falls in love with it, or might they think this is a really an author with that we can really promote? The author's well known, or is it a combination of things, or none of those?
I think it's all of the above, really, to tell you the truth. I think that most decisions are made by consensus these days in publishing houses. There's still a place for the editor's or the publicist's passion, but there are certain kind of infrastructural things that go on. For example, my author, Phil Duran, whose memoir, The Reluctant Tuscan, is a lead title for Gotham, which is a division of Penguin, this spring, his book was a rep's pick. And the reps kind of came forth and said, we really love this book. We want to really push this book. We're going to talk it up to the independent bookstores because those are the ones who often start the word of mouth. And, of course, they expect a goodbye from the chains as well. In fact, all that stuff is in place already because the selling goes on quite a long time before the book comes out. But it's the phenomenon of being a rep's pick. The same thing happens to be true for Joy Nicholson's second novel, which is coming out this spring. She had a big success with The Tribes of Palos Verdes, and St. Martin's is her publisher, and they are publishing The Road to Esmeralda. And I just want to kick my heels up when I hear that something is a rep pick. Because so many books are published, it's alarming. I mean, it's fabulous and it's alarming. It's a good thing and it's a bad thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, as an agent, you do handle literary fiction, you handle nonfiction. Do you get cold feet around literary fiction when something comes in? Or are you not thinking, oh, it's really hard to sell, and are you just going by what you like?
You can't help but think that it's really hard to sell, but what I like to do is succumb to the love factor. So if almost against my more rational instincts, I fall in love with it, then I'm going to take it on. And I've had really good luck so far, knock on wood, doing that. And a lot of the more difficult books that I've taken on, Mary Rayko's The Memory Room, which is a beautiful book. It happens to be a fairly long novel in verse, not rhyming verse, but verse all the same. Counterpoint published, and it got a star at Publishers Weekly. And then Bloomsbury published my client Steve Carter's I Was Howard Hughes, which is a very funny book with an unreliable narrator, and it has an unconventional narrative in that it's kind of a pastiche of imaginary diary entries and interviews and notes and things. And he got a star at Kirkus. So that kind of thing is very reinforcing to me.
Yes, interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm here with Betsy Amster. She is a literary agent in Los Angeles. Reviews, starred reviews, how do they affect the selling of the book, or do they? And can you even track it?
I think that it creates, because often these reviews are trade reviews and advance reviews, it creates a certain excitement in the house, and that is handy. Whether it ends up, you couldn't really quantify how it ends up affecting the sales. I think there are a lot of other factors that enter in. But it makes the publishing world sit up and take notice, mm-hmm. and that's very helpful.
Sure. Well, what about, there's more and more going on online with, various websites that are basically publications that don't publish a paper copy, or blogs, or things that are just so online, internet based. How worthy are they, and how much do publishers take notice?
Well, I know they are starting to pay attention to the fact that many bloggers recommend books to their readers, and I think they feel that that has an influence. There are also online, Web del Sol is kind of an online site where various short stories and so forth are published, and I think that that can be a handy way to get your name out there. How much reading and scanning agents have time to do of these things, I don't know.
Uh-huh. Well, speaking of Web del Sol, because I love that site, but I wonder, especially for those writers I know who are working on short stories and hope to do a short story collection at some point, and so need to get stories published first so that they can actually go into a collection, then how important are these sites? I mean, does it only count if your short story finds publication in The New Yorker or Tin House, or can it, you know, I mean, how much energy should you put into any publication or just certain publications if you want there to be notice of what you did?
I think you have to prioritize them. I think there's no question that a national slick magazine like The New Yorker, you know, publication there or in The Atlantic or Harper's is going to make a really big difference. The New Yorkers really notice that. And, you know, I think it's perfectly fine to have a combination of online and print publications. I think showing that you're serious about your work and you want to get it out there is really good. I think the reality of the matter for short story collections is that they are murder to sell. They are unbelievably hard. I have had luck with linked short stories. You had my client Paul Mandelbaum on a couple of weeks ago.
Garrett and Wedlock.
Yes, Garrett and Wedlock.
Book.
And Dwight Allen, who has done a novel and stories called The Green Suit.
Yeah.
That's what I've had the best luck with. They're amazingly difficult to sell. Difficult to sell to the publishers and then for the publishers to sell at the bookstore level.
Yeah. But interconnected short stories that become a novel,
they have more of a storyline.
Uh-huh.
They're less disparate. They add up more. I really love them.
Yeah, I do too. But I find it really interesting that there are all these short stories out there. There's obviously people reading short stories. And yet, as you said, it's really difficult to sell collections. Or I think earlier today we communicated about essay collections, and you said those also were really difficult.
Very tough, unless you're Anna Quinlan. Maureen Dowd.
Yeah. Why is that?
Well, you know, there are certain perplexing things about publishing in general. And what I am always reminded of is the fact that for the vast majority of books, it's not a mass market enterprise. It's a very niche-y kind of enterprise. There was something, I don't know if your listeners know about Publisher's Lunch, but it's a wonderful online resource, tons of publishing information. It's put together by a fellow in New York who I think is a saint named Michael Cater. And he was talking today. There's a new way of keeping track of book sales called Nielsen Book Scan, which the publishers are relying heavily on because it tells them how many books sell out of stores as opposed to how many books the publishers get into stores. And those are two very different numbers. And he was talking today about how over the holiday season, a scary percentage of books, in other words, the bestsellers, a very small number of bestsellers accounted for a very large percentage of total sales. And that is kind of sobering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is sobering. It's,
I know. We just have to carry on despite it all. I don't even really know what to make of all these trends sometimes.
Well, you know, speaking of book scan and publishers and authors selling books, now I also know authors who keep books around so that they can sell them to people that want them, and then they just order more. To my way of thinking, and then they get a discount from the publisher. To my way of thinking, though, I can't imagine a publisher really counting that. I would think the publisher is more interested in the bookstore sales, not what the author is selling. Am I totally off the wall here?
No, I think they are especially interested in bookstore sales. And authors will often arrange for bookstores to handle the sale of their book at venues where they are speaking. And I've gone to book parties in people's houses where Dutton's or Skylight, you know, bookstores up where I am, are handling the book sales.
Really?
And I think that's really smart.
Now, is that because the author thinks they're going to sell, you know, 30, 50, 100? I mean, I would think they would only come out for large quantities.
You know, you take your chances in any of those situations. You don't really know how many books are going to sell. Certainly when it's a book party, the people are your friends and interested colleagues. I think that's a smart way of doing it.
Yes.
Do it through a bookstore.
Yeah.
Give them the business.
Yeah, it is. It is the way. That's interesting, though. I wasn't aware that stores would actually go to houses. But see, you know, we don't ask questions and they don't come.
Well, sometimes I feel that, you know, every author is aware of practically every book that has been sold.
Yeah.
And works hard to sell every individual book.
Mm-hmm. Well, then getting back to BookScan, is this something that, I realize publishers rely on this, but is it sort of gospel for them when an agent brings an author, an author's proposal to a house or a manuscript to a house, and this author has a book or more out, are they studying sales of previous books?
Most of them are. Some of them are not yet. I don't know why. And it can really close things down, unfortunately.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm talking with Betsy Amster, a literary agent in Los Angeles. I'm really curious about this because you hear so many stories where authors' books just weren't promoted at all, and perhaps they didn't have the cash to hire a publicist. Independent publicist can cost anywhere from, I don't know, $5,000 to $50,000. I mean, can really eat up some money. And so you have a wonderful book come out. It may get wonderful reviews and then not sell. And so what's befuddling to me is that then this author is looked at as being a poor risk when, in fact, in the beginning, they were, you know, just everyone's delight. But, they didn't sell.
It's annoying. I have to admit. I sometimes think, you know, you should change your name with every book or something. It is true that if you have no track record, you are a more marketable commodity, counterintuitive as that may seem. And sometimes, you know, it's still possible to beat the system. And in fact, you can beat the system a lot. You can't in every instance, but you can enough that you don't have to get entirely discouraged, or I don't have to get entirely discouraged.
Because you're the one who has to remain enthusiastic.
Yes. Okay. And I'm still pleasantly surprised, let's put it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. I mean, that's encouraging.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about sort of a different aspect of publishing, and that is the actual writing. Now, I know in fiction, voice is really important, and I suppose it is in certain nonfiction too. But and I'm bringing this up because somebody emailed me this week, a loyal listener emailed me and asked me about, you know, voice, that you know, often the advice given is to write the way you speak, and yet if you read certain passages or certain novels out loud of you know, authors that are just that have been around a long time, you know, have been bestsellers, that their writing does not sound, you know, the way they might speak, that their writing doesn't even sound that great read aloud. So I don't even know what my question is to you. I guess it's about voice and what you look for, what you listen for when say, you know, 50 pages of a literary novel or any novel comes in.
I like someone who is very attentive down to the word level. And when I think, for example, of Paul Mandelbaum and Dwight Allen, my two novel and story writers, there are words in their pieces. Their word choices will thrill me. I like a sense of humor. I like someone who is daring, my author Maria Escandon, whose second novel is coming out to a lot of fanfare this spring. Gonzalez and Daughter Trucking Company is one of the most inventive writers and most vivid. A lot of this novel is set in the Mexicali Penal Institute for Women, for example, and she makes it sound a wee bit like a country club. you know, she's just really clever. I like people who can handle emotions well. I also really like self-editors, and I think that that's apparent in people's work. When they are perfectionists, functional perfectionists, inspired perfectionists, I think it shows up in their work. And that's what I meant when I said I like work that's fully realized.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it is not uncommon for me to do a little bit of editing, but really in the grand scheme, it tends to be a little bit. It's not scrubbing.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. You mentioned gift books earlier, too. I think this is one area that most writers probably never consider as even, you know, we go buy them all the time when we're in Barnes & Noble or Borders or any bookstore, any wonderful little bookstore. And I don't know that we think of these as viable options. Will you talk a little bit about gift books?
I think they are really fun. And it's one category where the author's platform is somewhat less important than others because it needs to be a beautiful object. And the author's ability to sell the book on his or her own is not as much of an issue as it would be, say, with a self-help book. They take an awareness of a specific audience. In other words, my author Sharon Montrose, who is a very gifted dog photographer, did a book called Lightweights, which shows her photographs of puppies on her collection of vintage scales. And she has a real audience for her books. They're dog owners, and it's just that they are irresistible. I am a cat person. I find them irresistible. I have an author named Allison Starcher who did a book called Good Bugs for Your Garden. She's an illustrator, and it's a hand-lettered, hand-illustrated book about the bugs you don't want to kill. It's a gift book for gardeners. The ones that are problematic are when people want to combine beautiful photographs with, snippets of poetry, you know, that kind of thing. The audience is very uncertain.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah. Oh, and here we are. We're heading toward our last minute. Any last words that you can offer our listeners who are maybe looking for an agent, maybe wanting to change agents, maybe figuring out if they're ready for an agent?
Well, I think that they should buy books on the publishing business. Susan Page's book, The Shortest Distance Between You and a Published Book, is a really good one. I think they should buy books on crafts. Your Pen on Fire is a really good one. There's so much information out there. I'm struck all the time by, in fact, it's not a closed universe. There's easy access to the information that people could make good use of. And so people should take advantage of that.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you. Thank you
again. A pleasure.
For coming on.
A pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. That was Betsy Amster, wonderful agent in Los Angeles. She is in various resource books on, writers, writing, agenting, finding an agent. And she is in Los Angeles. And if you're on this coast or any coast, I can't say enough about her. I'll stop now. And tell you that we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with Chris Beatty, author of No Plot, No Problem. So please stay tuned.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. You know, little darling, Rome wasn't built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We've been here since 5 p.m., broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at KUCI.org. We're KUCI FM 88.9. We were here for the first half with literary agent Betsy Amster, and now we are back with Chris Beatty. Chris is a freelance writer and writing coach whose work has appeared in the Washington Post, SF Weekly, and Lonely Planet guidebooks. He's author of No Plot, No Problem, a low-stress, high-velocity guide to writing a novel in 30 days, published by Chronicle Books. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Pleasure. Talk about No Plot, No Problem, and how this book came about.
Sure. Well, it arose out of something called National Novel Writing Month, which is a kind of grandiose titled event that actually is a very simple event, which I started back in 1999. And the idea of National Novel Writing Month was that I proposed to a group of friends of mine living here in the San Francisco Bay Area that we spend 1 month drinking way too much coffee and kind of dashing out a first draft of a novel in 30 days. And really, we just defined novel. It was not in terms of quality or, you know, in kind of the depth of literary sentiment, but it was more at 50,000 words. We had decided that once we hit 50,000 words, we had become novelists, and we could, at that point, tell everybody we were novelists. And that was sort of the heights of our literary ambition at the time. And that was back in 1999, and it ended up being so much, such an unexpected amount of fun, and really just kind of a great creative exercise that I did it again the following year, and this time kind of got an actual website and sent out the call to people who beyond my kind of immediate circle of friends, and that's kind of the way the event has grown. And it started so casually and so informally and with, you know, such appalling motivation. But this past year, we had the sixth annual National Novel Writing Month event, and it has become an international event. And we had about 42,000 people from all over the world participating, and 6,000 of those did answer the call and become month-long literary heroes by writing 50,000 words. And No Plot, No Problem is basically kind of a guidebook to that sort of 30-day, burst of creative mayhem. And it contains everything that I wish I had known about how to tackle a first draft in a short amount of time that I didn't, and packages it all nicely in a slim volume.
Mm. It's interesting, and 50,000 words is kind of a nice amount of words for a novel.
It is. I mean, I think it like 30 days itself is sort of it's a manageable amount. It's something that, 50,000 words, which is basically sort of a Catcher in the Rye,
sure.
A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, a shortish book. We don't say novella because it unfortunately doesn't impress people the way novel does. So. But it is something that, there's some heft to it. You know, when you print it out, you can drop that thing on the floor and it'll scare small children and dogs. But it's not so much that you can kind of get lost in it. It really is. There's sort of a light at the end of the tunnel with 50,000 words.
Yeah, and the whole idea is to write fast and madly and to keep moving. And I love this bit you have early on in the book where you say, as Isaac Newton observed, objects in motion tend to stay in motion.
Right. I mean, I think
I love that.
Yeah, it's really true. I mean, I think the other saying that I think applies to that is, if you want something to get done, ask a busy person to do it, because it really, once you are in motion and kind of already tackling a certain number of things, such as a family or, a social life or, work or school, it's somehow just easier to add some other big project to that and kind of juggle them all, because in essence, your limbs are limbered by that juggling act that you're doing already. And I think that the idea of kind of compressing it all into 30 days, it sounds sort of horrifying and seems sort of counterintuitive to the idea of, really spending years honing this book. And I think that sort of year-long approach is a very valid one. But I would say that the first draft is going to be one. It's a wild, hairy time. You know, there's just so much. There's so much that's going to go into that first draft that you're going to end up deleting later, or you know, ideas will spark other ideas, and it's sort of a process where you have to kind of wander into the woods and let yourself be lost for a little while. And I think that you end up with the same quality first draft whether you give yourself, you know, a month or two or a year or two. I think it's, you know, and the important thing is really just to keep that momentum going so that you do have a chance to kind of just let that imagination take over and see where it leads.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I am here with Chris Beatty, author of No Plot, No Problem, A Low-Stress, High-Velocity Guide to Writing a Novel. What do you say to people that, and my students look at me when I tell them, just write, just write, just write, just write every day, just keep it going. And they look at me and they say, but aren't I going to get stuck if I don't know what I'm doing, if I don't have a plot? What do you say to that?
Well, I believe you me, 6 years ago, I would have looked at you with the exact same, mix of confusion and terror, you know, because I think, you know, there is this sense where I think that as people who love books, we kind of ascribe this otherworldly ability to novelists, you know, or to writers. We think of them as, you know, they're a different species. You know, they have probably a swollen brain in various places. And I think that, you know, we have this idea that, you know, that novels are written by novelists, and that's kind of the way it is. But, you know, I think that all humans possess this uncanny and really kind of freaky ability to kind of conjure, to take kind of basic ideas, you know, maybe just a vision of, you know, an old woman who is, you know, walking down the street with a very ugly dog. Everybody's brain just can kind of, you say, okay, well, where's this woman going? And I think people say, well, she's going to visit her daughter. And okay, well, who's her daughter? And I think this kind of just step-by-step creative building process is one that everybody can do, and it actually is, you know, when you do make a point of doing it regularly, you know, every day, you do just end up surprising yourself with the things you come up with, and you don't have to be a particularly somebody, you know, who's, you're a right brain person, you know, somebody who's kind of has a lot of out there ideas. I think everybody has this ability, and actually exercising that part of your brain just feels wonderful. You know, it just becomes this kind of exciting and enchanted realm that's sort of like it's almost like a series of rooms that are located in a house that you've lived in your whole life that you never knew were there. And, you know, it's just by this writing process that you open that first door and say, you know, oh, here's a weird extra kitchen I didn't know I had. And then mm-hmm. you step through that door and just keep going.
Hmm. Of course, something else I love about your book and your whole premise is that what you, and you say this in it often, what you need really to write a novel or to get any writing done is a deadline.
Right.
Will you talk about that?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think from in my freelance writing pursuits, I have learned that, you know, once I have that deadline, I will procrastinate up to a certain point, and I will wait until that sort of that mix of terror and dread kicks into the point that I'm forced to sit down at that computer and write. Without that pressure, you know, the kind of demands of everyday life really take precedent, you know, that I do need to make sure that I reliably pay my power bill or my quarterly income tax statements or something. And there are always those things. And you really, I think, need something to push novel writing from kind of the bottom of the to-do list all the way up to the top. And I think that a deadline is just a fantastic way to do that. And unfortunately, you know, I think deadlines are wildly powerful things, but we get them all the time. You know, unfortunately, though, they are rarely in the life domains that interest us. Oftentimes, they are bosses giving us deadlines on, you know, projects or proposals that we're supposed to put together. And so the idea of creating a deadline for something that really is only going to benefit us, that is just sort of a personal pleasure, I think, is kind of a foreign one. And it's something, you know, the question is, well, how do I give that deadline the same oomph that it might have if you know, a snarling boss had given this to me? And I think that's the real challenge. And I talk about some ways to do that in No Plot, No Problem, where you kind of feel like, oh, God, you know, okay, I've given myself 30 days, and I have to be accountable to this. But I think it is just, a deadline is just the most powerful thing you can do for your writing, in that it gives you structure, and it helps you you know, kind of pace yourself. And it just basically makes you sit down and put in that writing time that's going to just, you know, really pay off big time in the long run.
I think that a lot of people might have the false impression that to write a novel or to write 50,000 words, certainly in 1 month, means that they need to not do anything else.
Right, yeah.
What do you think?
Well, that's another idea. That I had kind of this idea that a novel would tumble out of me as soon as I was able to somehow con my way into a writer's retreat. You know, one of those kind of mythical places where, you know, I would turn and all my favorite writers would be sitting by the fountain with quills in hand, and, you know, and that was kind of all they were supposed to do for 3 months. And I have just learned that for me anyway, I think that when you have nothing to do but write, it is hard to do anything. You know, I am actually, right now I'm kind of, National Novel Writing Month ended in November, and the kind of cleanup from it stretched into December, and so now it's January, and I have a novel draft that it's now my third draft, and I need to be finished with it, but I don't really have that sort of terrifying pressure. So I spend the day with that computer on, and what I'm doing is the very important process of checking my email over and over and over again, which is essential. If you're not checking it, you know, 12 times an hour, you may miss something. And, so anyway, I think that's what I get for not having, you know, a strong deadline. And I almost want to set up kind of an artificial deadline where I tell my agent that, you know, she's going to hack off one of my limbs or something, please, you know, give me something scary to help motivate me. And I think that kind of idea that, you know, that we need to have just unlimited time to allow our muse to work, I think just fundamentally it just doesn't work. It hasn't worked for me. I think the time, you know, again, that idea of juggling projects, it's the time when you get the most stuff done is when you are having to sandwich it in between real life. And I think, you know, I think that that's also an idea that comes out in your book a lot. You know, this idea that you need to make writing, just kind of shove it in there. You know, yes, your life is busy. Yes, your life is full. But cram that thing in there and you'll be the better for it.
That's interesting. That's the only way I tend to get things done. Sometimes, though, I think I'm too busy. And when I am too busy, the thing that tends to fall away is the fiction I'm working on.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I wish I didn't do that. And I have to figure out a way not to do that. But, you know, it's like, well, this may never get published. And I think a lot of people go through that. They,
right.
Especially working writers or journalists. Or, you know, if you make your money writing nonfiction, you go, well, you know, I really have to pay attention to the bread and butter money.
Right. I think it's true. Well, also, you know, novels, unlike nonfiction, you know, which is usually a mercifully short endeavor. I mean, you know, it could be 300 words or 1,500 words or, you know, the upper end would be like 3,000 words. And that's a pretty long story. But, you know, a novel, these things, they just go on forever. And that's what makes them so wonderful to read. You know, you're able to really, you know, you just lose yourself in these stories and worlds and characters. But as a writer, you know, they are such a tangle of plot and motif, and I think that, you know, once that slips off your to-do list for the day, you know, and I know for me it's basically a two-day rule that if I stay away from whatever fiction I'm working on for 2 days, it just is hard for me to get back into it again, you know, and so, I mean, I think that's true, that it's so hard to make it a priority, and it's also daunting. It's very easy to lose the trail and lose momentum, and I think for me that's why a 30-day, a very intense period where that's kind of, you know that every day, or at least, you know, 5 days a week usually, for a couple hours a day, you will be really kneading this dough of a story and really spending a lot of time, you know, working on it, and I think that helps me stay in the story and stay in the mind frame.
Will you give your website before I forget?
Sure. It's nanowrimo.org, and that's kind of an acronym for National Novel Writing Month. You can also just Google National Novel Writing Month.
Yes, and it will come up. What about where you write? Do you tend to change locations for the different things you write? Or, I'll ask you my second question later.
Oh, well, I think for me, I have an office, and it's a wonderful office. I pay rent in $2 increments for cups of coffee, and it's a coffee shop in Berkeley, California that that has just this perfect blend for me of innocuous music. It's classical music, kind of played at very low volumes, and they have comfortable seats, and there are outlets for the laptop. And I do basically both my almost all of my nonfiction writing there, and then I work on fiction there as well. And for me, when I try to work at home, I think I am far too susceptible to the dirty kitchen must be clean syndrome, you know, the sense of getting very distracted and all these tantalizing loose ends that always are lying around the home front.
I thought it was so funny that at least you used to wear, what, a Vikings hat or something?
Yeah, definitely. You got
in the cafe?
No, I don't take the Viking helmet out to the coffee shop. I think what you're talking about is kind of, for me, I find that part of the fun of this sort of 30-day journey into novel land is sort of dressing up and kind of making it the theater that I'd always hoped novel writing would be. And so, you know, sometimes when the going gets particularly tough, I have an alternating series of headgear that goes on. And the ultimate, should my book really need some work, it's this plastic Viking helmet that never ceases to scare the characters into line. They start behaving as soon as that thing goes on.
That's great. I am talking with Chris Beatty, who is author of No Plot, No Problem, a low-stress, high-velocity guide to writing a novel in 30 days, published by Chronicle Books. And we actually are going to be in San Diego. I was going along thinking it was Sunday, and somebody today reminded me that it's Saturday.
Well, I'm glad you realized that today. That's much more convenient than realizing it on Sunday.
Yeah. I was going to be down there Sunday. And I was planning on a Sunday ride. You know, I will be there though now that I know. But maybe we should talk a little bit about what's going to happen there.
Yeah, definitely.
Go ahead.
Well, okay. Thank you, Barbara.
And it's at the La Jolla Library, and it's sponsored by Warwick's Books. And while you're talking, I'm going to find a website for Warwick so I can give it out. So
okay, that sounds good. Well, it's going to be a 2.5-hour long sort of writing talk where Barbara and I are going to just kind of talk about sort of who we are as writers briefly, and then kind of get into the juicier parts, which are kind of addressing ideas about, we all love books and we all really enjoy writing. And so the question is, how do we work that more into these, you know, ridiculously busy lives that a lot of us have? And so we're going to kind of go through some of the things that I think keep us from writing, and then also talk about the things that can help us get to that, to get to spending more time in that sort of crazy kitchen off the main house that I was talking about earlier.
Yes, and I found it. It's warwicks.com, warwicks.com. And I guess you have to sign. It's a free workshop, but you have to sign up prior to that day. So they make sure they have enough seats and you get in. So do it. And
yeah. I think you just have to call them, I think, is the extent of the sign-up thing. So it's really easy.
You know, fiction is really interesting in that it really is a whole other aspect of writing and uses a whole different part of your creativity, especially if you write. I mean, so many journalists still want to write the novel, still put out short stories or write poetry. It just does something else entirely. And I think it's important for us to pay attention to, no matter, you know, how you make your living. Not that you can't start making a living writing fiction, because it does happen. It does happen.
I've heard of a couple people who do that.
Yeah, there's a few people that do that. But that's no reason really to just, you know, let it even influence you. You know, everything is not about making a living. And I think with writing, sometimes writers get lost in that, you know, that, well, I make my living doing nonfiction, so, you know, why should I take time away?
Right. Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah.
I mean, you make your living, you know, doing nonfiction.
Correct. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Being a writing coach, doing all this stuff. And do you ever feel guilty about putting time into fiction? And when you do, what do you do with yourself?
Well, I don't know if I feel I think I would. I'm terrified not to write a novel a year now because I feel like I would look like such a poser.
You're the spokesman,
sort of the alleged organizer of this National Novel Writing Month, who just kind of sat it out and waved at people from the sidelines. So there is guilt there, but usually it's guilt for not writing a novel, which is kind of, I think, a good position to be in. But I do know that feeling where, and I think it only gets to be more of a pressure, I think, once you have a family, and it's, you know, there is a certain, you know, you do need to provide some income for children, because when they don't have clothes, they tend to be unhappy, and, you know, similar for lack
true.
Of food. And
yeah, it is true.
But I think that, you know, I do think it's this sense of there is this part of our brains that we, you know, we don't often tap into. And when you do hit it, when you do lose yourself in that, when you hit that flow, it is like nothing else. You know, it's just such an amazing feeling, and it's open to anybody. You know, it's just... and I think that it is crucial that because it's so non-practical that we do make a point of going there, you know, and make a point of doing that, you know, both for ourselves, but I think also because that's really, you know, I think so many of the books that we've loved have come out of somebody saying, okay, I know this doesn't make sense financially, but I just need to do this. I just need to try this. And, you know, that's, I think that has resulted in some of the greatest books of all time. You know, it's just that impulse that this is dumb, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Right. Oh, I love this book. I love this book of yours, and I really appreciate the writing of this book because it's so fun and irreverent and just, I think it's, you know, it's not only a lesson in how to write a novel in a month, but it's a lesson in how to write well because, you know, you're such a good writer and it's so fun to read. And, yeah, I really like it. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, thank you. I had tried, I think, to kind of have a lighter tone because I think sometimes writing books can kind of get bogged down in the sense of this is an intense craft that, you know, you have to, you know, furrow your brow and look very intently at very serious. And but I think it can be a wonderful kind of, it's kind of a like a literary block party and, you know, bookish hoedown as well. So I think it's important not to lose the sense of fun.
Well, thank you for coming on the show, and I will be seeing you in a couple of days.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. This has been great.
You're quite welcome. That was Chris Beatty, author of No Plot, No Problem, A Low-Stress, High-Velocity Guide to Writing a Novel in 30 Days. And it's published by Chronicle, and truly, this is just such a fun read. I, you know, having written a writing book, I'm especially critical of writing books, and I love it. I think it's just so fun, and everything he's saying here is making sense. And if you find yourself kind of dawdling and not working on that novel, you know, check his book out. Just, you know, go in the bookstore, start reading it, see what happens. I think it will speak to you. And again, we will be at the La Jolla Library this weekend, Saturday. You can find out more also by going to my website, which is penonfire.com, and click on appearances, and you will find Warwick's link if you need it. What else? If you want to know more about who's going to be on the show, actually, I have a whole new webpage for the show that's linked to my site. You go to penonfire.com, you click on the radio tower on the left side of the screen. Dave Masso of Spacious Mind Web Design just did a wonderful job with this website, I think. And I have a blog as well that it's going to be more and more stuff happening with that. So email me, tell me that you heard the show, that you're coming to San Diego or La Jolla. And I will leave you now with a quote by Corrie ten Boom, who said, "Worry is like a rocking chair. It keeps you moving, but doesn't get you anywhere." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Stay tuned for Between the Lines. Until next week.
At my door, the leaves are falling.